This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Good afternoon. I'd like to acknowledge the Yuggera people from where I come in Brisbane, Australia, as well as the local traditional owners, Indigenous traditional owners of the country here. Title of my talk is Deep Time Evolution of the Indigenous People and Architecture of Australia. The presentation traces 70,000 years of cultural evolution in Aboriginal Australia, starting with the ancient crossing from Sunda to Sahul, then the relatively swift continental colonisation during the Ice Age, through the severe impacts on survival during the last glacial maximum and the socio-territorial reconfigurations that occurred during the Holocene sea level rise. The Australian Aboriginal world had become characterised by a habitation style with low environmental impact, complex social organisation systems anchored with constructed sacred origin histories, the persistence of relatively simple dwelling types but situated with complex settlement socio-spatial structures, and a high quality of life for most, with institutional dispute resolution mechanisms to contain conflicts, and all integrated into what I call a fractal system. The first set of migrations of peoples started prior to 65,000 before present, at the time of the Ice Age, when sea levels were much lower. At this time, the region was divided between the landmass of the southeastern Eurasian continent, which incorporated the contemporary islands of Sumatra, Java, Bali, Borneo, this land being now termed Sunda by scientists, and a separate continent now termed Sahul that incorporated New Guinea, Australia and Tasmania. And you can see that the black arrows indicate the two entry points across the deep rift of Wallacea between. And the green here gives you the extent of Sahul with the connections between New Guinea, Australia and Tasmania as one landmass. And showing the superhighways prior to 50,000 years during the Ice Age as people travelled across the continent and colonised the different parts and spread out very quickly. And these routes were to evolve into trunk trade routes across the continent, which were still active at the time of the early colonial anthropologists in the late 19th century. The fractal system of Aboriginal social organisation of inland Australia is in order of the hypothesised overlay of its humanising elements. Firstly, the colonising kin groups expand out on the continent, following routes connecting water sources. Secondly, a base camp might be established with a perennial water source and selected and established by a kin group. Daily food gathering then occurs by gendered subgroups in surrounding resource places. The kin group develops and establishes a kinship system with rules of marriage and descent. The kin group develops into a clan structure with rules of exogamy with adjoining clans. Also developed is a defined estate of owned and named sites held by the clan. The history of the estate colonisation is embellished as an oral history, telling of the first ancestors and their travels and adventures at the different sites. Then the ancestors become portrayed as animistic entities with mixed human and totemic identities, as well as totemic designs, songs and ceremonies. These sacred ancestral histories become authority for clan totemic identity and primary ownership of rights and rights in estate. And the last overlay into the system is the skin or class system, which gives each clan and each and its affiliated sites, estate and totems a unique skin identity. The fractal system of Aboriginal world creation over 70,000 years thus encompasses and integrates the overlaid humanising elements of kinship, land tenure, totems, art emblems of totems, songs and ceremonies, classificatory skin relationships, animistic human identity, religion and economic hunting foraging practices. Here I've made a simple illustration of a set of contiguous clan estates, each one being represented by a cluster of coloured dots. There weren't lineal boundaries between these estates, rather they were identified by sites, a cluster of sites which had a common primary totemic identity. Thus we have a couple of kangaroo estates there, a couple of emu, a couple of rain, and a couple of python. And an indication where travel routes might have occurred between some of the ancestral beings who travelled. And those identities of those clans were transposed into large-scale settlements through the idea of socio-spatial structures, whereby groups or clan groups formed their own camps in particular arrangements and spatial, according to spatial rules, and including further subdivisions for subgroups who might have been individual family descent lines. And these are still to be seen in parts of in the interior of Australia today. In general, but kinship is very complex in the Aboriginal societies and involves many rules. I haven't got time to go into them today. Two critical points, but there was clan exogamy and patrifiliation, so that the children of a man took over his clan area and became affiliated with that clan and inherited the totems of that clan. The wives were obtained from adjacent clans. The wives came to live in their husband's area in the estate, but their children took on the clan identity of their fathers. Overlaid with that, as I said, was a skin system. Again, quite complex. This diagram shows an 8 subsection system. In this arrangement, I'm a Kamarangi skin. You can see me there, and I marry the equal signs of marriage relationships. So I marry a Budurini woman. As a Kamarangi, the vertical black lines are father-child links. So as a Kamarangi, my father is a Burulangi. The Burulangi man is married to a Ngaribalangi woman, so my mother is a Ngaribalangi. Her father, in turn, is a Bangarinji, so that's my father, my mother's father, and my mother's mother is a Yakamari. Exemplar for the first extreme climate change in Sahul at the last glacial maximum about 20,000 years ago, when it was a period of aridification and prolonged droughts for many years. A case study of the Wakaya Desert and the Davenport Range refugia. In the centre there, the diagonal lines represent the Wakaya Desert. To the southwest of that is a set of numbers, a cluster of numbers, which are estates in the Davenport Ranges, which had perennial water sources. Which I call a refugia, a place where people retreated to from surrounding areas in times of drought. And on the eastern side of the desert, the upper drainage basin of the Georgina River. Here we have a rainmaking ceremony in the Davenport Ranges, whereby the rainmakers ritually carry out this ceremony, I believe was probably... improvised or embellished during this last glacial maximum period. So here we can see the one of the senior men being carried by his grandson as they travel up the valley to the rainmaking site, and he's got the eagle feathers tucked in his back belt. And they visit this white ochre pit, which is rain dreaming, and to dig out white ochre for the ceremony. And then proceed to the saddle where the elder invokes rain by throwing ochre into the air and pulling in the clouds from the Gulf of Carpentaria with the eagle hawk feathers and making incantations. And here we have what I was referring to as the sacred emblem of these sites. The two black concentric circles represent the two rain areas, or the two rain sites, the two ochre pits, one's being a stationary rain and one a travelling rain. These These sacred paintings are then erased once displayed to novices. And here we have another map of the desert area showing the travel route of an ancestral being, a long-tailed railba or black-headed python, as it travels across the country making soakages and naming them and leaving songs and sacred objects at the soakages. And reaching to the north of the site meets a short-tailed python and swaps the territory of the short-tailed python for a fire stick, giving the fire stick to the short-tailed python who travels on north across the country. This becomes the Buruguara estate or country, and the people who descended from this in this area identify with the black-headed python totem. And here we are in a field trip travelling across this desert, looking for these soakages. Tracking soakages in the desert is quite a difficult task, because the soakages are, for those who don't know, are wells dug into the ground where the water table comes higher and that you can obtain water. But in the 50 or 60 years since people had used these soakages, they'd filled in with sand, so they were quite difficult to find. And here we have a ceremonial demonstration of this python dreaming, with the sacred painting drawn on the ground and also some of the objects that were left behind by the ancestral being, which is said to contain the perpetual energies of the sacred site left behind by the Dreamtime people. So I have the idea that the whole of the continent is covered in sacred sites, and each one contains a perpetual energy left behind by the ancestral beings, which is still there today. As one old man taught me, humming, they're our generators, still humming. And switching to another slide from this period, in the north, in Arnhem Land, of the northern part of Australia. Again, in this period between 35 and 23,000 years ago, a place that had been occupied for 200 generations, there was a strata of rock that had been removed by the weather and left behind these columns, natural columns of stone, holding up the upper strata from the lowermost strata. And the Aboriginal people here actually knocked out some of these columns to create wider social spaces and to create ceiling surfaces on which they could paint their totemic histories of this region. A remarkable site of antiquity. And we're about to move to the coastal area. Here we have this dance about the suffering of the rainbow serpent. Australian anthropologists have argued that the widespread Aboriginal rainbow serpent myths, as being guardians of the perennial waterholes, arose during periods of prolonged droughts. Did they originate during the last glacial maximum, or at least were widely embellished then? However, the presence of the rainbow serpent at Mornington Island must belong to the late Holocene, telling of his metamorphosis from land human to sea creature. And here we have a map of Mornington Island showing the extent of the coastline during the Holocene at 6,500 years BP. The archaeology dates occupation only as far back as 3,000 BP. The sacred histories involve various sea creatures cutting the channels between the islands as they were created as the sea levels come up. At the time of contact with Europeans, there were some 29 estates, coastal estates, around the coast. And note that little small island there, Sydney Island. I'm just going to show a map of the geography there that I did, showing the coastal-centric naming of the country. 30 coastal place names, all on the coast virtually. They're about a half a kilometre to a kilometre apart. And you can see the different textures pertain to different habitats. The outermost habitat on the edge, on the coast, are usually sand-based systems in which perennial wells can be located, freshwater wells. And they were the main occupation sites the sites where all of the sacred sites occur along the coast. In these islands also, some 334 fish traps occur, made from rock walls. The idea is that at high tide, the water comes over the rock walls, and then when the tide goes out at low tide, fish are left inside these rock walls. So Matthew Flinders, the early explorer, described them as fish farms or fish paddocks. And here we have some examples of sacred sites, this one being the stone bodies of the first creators of the coastal sites, Manbul, his wife Jinjin, and her brother Dildil. And here another site, what the anthropologists call an increased ritual or fertility ritual site for the bluefish species, a freshwater spring in a tidal rock platform. So at high tide, there's salt water over the top of this, but there's still fresh water coming out of the hole. And another sacred site, a set of underwater caves or cavities in a reef for making floods. And here we have a flood maker who's taking white ochre. He's going to swim out and put the white ochre inside these caves, which is said to antagonise Tuatu, the rainbow serpent, who will then be so angered that he will make a flood. We find that at the time of first contact, there were three shelter types, or three archetypes. The wet weather shelter, which has now been superseded by houses, the windbreak and the shade shelter. The windbreak and shade shelter are now made with acculturated material, so they're still in use. The modern windbreak is made with galvanised iron sheets and fence posts, steel fence posts. And the shade shelter is made in a very sophisticated way with steel structures and spinifex grass between chicken wire as a roof. And there we have the stone napper, one of the last stone mappers in Australia, who also hafts his blades to handles. Larry will be interested. And there's no evidence that these shelters were any different at the time, 70,000 years ago, when Aboriginal people entered the continent. I suspect that they arrived with these shelter types, so it was of interest to see that windbreak in the cave before. And they arrive with their basic toolkit of things like hunting and fighting implements and fire-making sticks and ritual materials, wearing different body apparel and so forth. So we can talk about that more tomorrow. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.